Hello, and welcome to 4Panel, the Geek Show Network's podcast about comics, graphic novels, and other related artistic media like manga and the like. And I'm joined tonight by Andrew, as usual.
That's me.
And John, as unusual.
Who's this John fella?
Yeah.
John. Rob.
Yes.
Rob.
Yes.
Scratch that. And Rob, as unusual.
Yes. Hello.
I'll never be asked to introduce the show again, will I?
No, I'm actually tempted to keep all of that in. But I do have I do have to ask, if I'm John, who are you?
I have no name. I am no one.
Are you going to do your...
Maybe the real John was inside us all along.
No, John was not inside me.
That was just a vicious rumour.
I think I would have known.
Not from what I've heard about John.
I'm locking my door from now on. Anyway, as I was going to say, are you doing your Clint Eastwood in Pale Rider? Mysterious stranger rides into town and saves everybody.
That's just my day job.
I think he's doing more of the Clint Eastwood having a mental breakdown and talking to an empty chair.
Ouch. Oh,
that's... oh, that happened years ago.
Oh, so how are you guys this week?
Well, clearly mentally unstable.
That's why we read comics.
But yeah, not too bad.
Welcome to 4Panel. We have a lot of issues.
Hey!
Oh.
Go on, follow that, Rob.
I can't follow that.
If you are, Rob.
I think so.
No, I think we have to end the show. That was the best joke any of us will ever make.
This is true. Oh. Anyway, there's not much happening in the world of comic books for some reason. You'd think there would be a lot more going on, but no.
Maybe it's because it's summer and everyone's out doing things instead of sitting at home reading comics by gaslight.
Well, do you know who isn't out and doing things?
Well, us three, obviously.
And all the pasty nerds, I assume, make up our audience. Love you guys.
Yep. And also, Batman writer Tom King, who has pitched a Sergeant Rock story to DC Comics because, and his words, he was in the mood to write about heroes fighting Nazis.
Yeah, this is a very deep and complex news issue, and we're certainly not just mentioning it because it ties into a certain recent event that's garnered a lot of attention online, and maybe this will get us in those search results.
Well, and not only that, but I think in Tom's pitch announcement, he did say, for some reason, I'm in the mood.
Yeah. So it's either current events or he's been playing a bit too much Wolfenstein.
Yes.
Wolfenstein would be a very different game if all the Nazis and that came at you with cheap tiki torches.
Yeah, that would be a very, very different game. But anyway, what do you guys think about this possible return to war comics?
Well, I think it's one of those things that's always had a market. There's always a section of the market that wants to read Adventures of Daring Do. But my concern is that it'll end up crossing over in some way with spandex-clad heroes.
You mean like the Howling Commandos did?
Yeah.
I don't know. I'd quite like to see just a normal war comic again, because I haven't seen one for decades.
I just wonder if, like DC is the right home for something like that. Maybe they could do with a new imprint or use one of the existing imprints. Because it feels like DC is synonymous with the costumed hero type. I just wonder if it'd be better done, cause you know, Vertigo hasn't always focused just on like your traditional superhero. Maybe it'd sit better in the Vertigo imprint.
That's a possibility.
Yeah, it could be Vertigo or maybe like Young Animal if they wanted to go a bit more stylized with it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And the last war comic that I read was one called The Nam, which was, it was serialized in the Punisher comic that was coming out, in like newsagents across the UK, during the late 80s, early 90s.
Yeah.
And that was the last war comic I ever read.
I mean, I know, I don't know whether they still do there used to be a one that was like a pocket-sized war comic. And if the two of you would like to continue talking about this story while I just quickly do some research.
So, those war comics, Andrew.
Didn't Tom King do Sheriff of Babylon?
I think so.
Yeah, and I believe that was Vertigo, wasn't it?
Yes. I think he did, was it Miracle Man or something like that? No, Mr. Miracle as well.
Well, that's literally just that idea of the week, hasn't it?
Yeah, I think he's doing that as well, isn't he?
Which is not a war comic in the slightest.
No, it's not.
Next Wave, that's a comic.
Did he do Next Wave?
No.
I was going to say.
But since we kind of stopped mentioning war comics, I thought I'd just start saying the names of comics.
Yeah. He's done it.
That's a comic as well.
Yeah, he did Sheriff of Babylon. And he did The Vision V2 with Gabriel Hernandez, Walter, and Michael Walsh. I think he did issue 7.
He was reading a list of comics that Tom King has written.
I found that Tom King on Wikipedia, yeah.
That's good. That's good. This is this hot content that people listen for.
Meanwhile, I can tell you that the war comic genre is alive and kicking. The Commando comics published by DC Thompson are released 4 issues every 2 weeks and are still going as they have been since 1961.
Wow.
So that's the people who bring you the Beano and the Dandy.
Yeah.
Now also do war comics.
I have done since the 1960s with artwork by John Ridgway, Ian Kennedy. You see, I remember my older brother used to collect these years and years ago, and they're like a sort of pocketbook edition. They're sort of an A5 size.
Yeah.
And they are just war-to-war heroes killing Nazis.
Yeah, I remember when I was a kid, they used to have like the pocketbook war comics. And they used to jump around a little bit. Most of it was World War II, but if it was an American one, they'd have Vietnam, and every so often, maybe the Korean War.
Yeah.
If it was a special occasion.
If it was a special occasion.
I'm just looking. In the early years, all Commando stories were devoted to the World War II, but recently they've extended the range to conflicts including World War I, Cold War, Spanish Civil War, Falklands, Korea, Vietnam, and ancient and medieval conflict as well. So,
yeah, but the ancient and medieval conflict doesn't. It's just not the same. It doesn't have as many explosions.
They've also done a couple of sort of speculative fiction type space war stuff, and also they've done the U.S. Civil War as well. So,
yeah, but everyone. Yeah,
so the war genre is still there. So it's, I think it can work. It just depends how DC manage it, I guess.
Everyone's done the US Civil War, though.
I haven't.
The strangest version of the US Civil War that I've ever seen on TV was a Polish take on the US Civil War.
What if everyone in the US Civil War was inexplicably Polish?
Basically, yeah. It was either that or it was an American program that had been dubbed into Polish. I could never quite tell.
Well, surely that would have been obvious by whether the lip movements matched the speech.
Well, you'd think it would be, but a lot of the actors are supposed to have like that, a lot of the Confederate actors are supposed to have that southern drawl to them. And for some reason, it seems that the mouth movements seem to match.
We're not even going into the realms of why you are watching Polish TV.
My brother's wife is Polish.
Okay, that explains it.
And well, that is a depressingly mundane explanation.
Hey, I'll have
that
you know.
It doesn't live up to the idea of, like, Polish people speaking Polish, but with a Southern American drawl.
See, that would have been amazing if that was the case. But sadly, it's not. Anyway.
I have a pitch for this series.
Okay.
I think it should be a really dark and gritty examination of the true horrors of the Second World War. And then in the final issue, Haunted Tank shows up. Haunted Tank. Like the Sherman tank inhabited by the ghost of General Sherman.
Oh, that. I remember now.
Actual comic book character.
Yep.
I don't remember that.
Andrew, I shall leave it to you to explain.
Right, the Haunted Tank is a tank that's haunted by a Confederate general.
Yeah.
Yeah, that bit I got from what you said earlier. He said explain, not reiterate.
Actually, that's it. That can be the final scene. So, like, the ghost of General Sherman or whoever it was turns directly to the reader and says, wow, I know I fought to keep people as slaves, but even I think these Nazi guys kind of suck.
I've just read here about the characteristic motifs in these British war comics that are still going. The stories contain certain characteristic motifs. To mention a few, courage, cowardice, patriotism, dying for the sake of one's country, noble actions, and making a cup of refreshing tea while in the face of danger.
And they do this all at the same time.
That's just issue one.
I've got to ask, do all of the commanding officers have mustaches?
Well, you see, I remember reading these as a kid, and yes.
You know, when I was reading them when I was a kid, I honestly thought that in order to be a commanding officer in the military, you had to have a mustache, I thought was a requirement.
Yeah, I can tell you that these are my memories of war comics when I was a child. All commanding officers have got the mustache you mentioned,
yep,
and smoke a pipe.
Yes, the pipe was the other thing.
All the rank and file soldiery talk with Cockney accents
and smoke cigarettes. Smoke rolled up cigarettes, not just cigarettes, rolled up cigarettes.
And are clean shaven.
Yeah.
And all Nazis have got scarred faces.
Yes, that was the other thing as well. All Nazis, they have like, you know, the jutting brow as well. You know,
How to spot a Nazi? All these old war comics were actually a subtle critique of the class system.
They might have been. We don't know.
No, I think they were written by people from a generation for whom, no, they were just a diagram of the class system.
Yes. Anyway, enough of war.
I thought it was like Pokemon, that if like a Cockney gets enough ranks, he evolves into an upper-class Britishman.
No. If a Cockney gets enough ranks, he evolves into a pearly king. Or a pearly queen,
yeah,
depending on whether male or female.
Bet the haunted tank would have allowed Cockneys to be generals.
He's fixated.
He's surprisingly progressive for a racist tank.
He's fixated on the tank now. Let's change story.
Yeah, let's do some more news.
Well, there's not much more. This is more of a mention than news, but DC are continuing their desecration of the Hanna-Barbera cartoons by redoing the Jetsons. And they redid the Flintstones, so obviously the Jetsons is going to be on the cards. And they've shown some artwork for it, and everyone looks generally fine, except for the robot maid, who's decidedly not cuboid.
Look, it's clear to me what's happened. Obviously, after the series finished, the producers said, look, you've let yourself go a little bit. Maybe, you know, to build your career, you need to maybe take some steps. And she's clearly bought a Davina McCall or Jane Fonda workout video, and she's stuck to it, bless her.
Yeah, the robot maid is decidedly curvy, but with the robot maid's head, which...
Yes.
It's just kind of, okay, I understand maybe DC wanted to sexify her up a bit, you know, make her look a bit sexier, but for some reason she kind of reminds me of Hattie Jack in all those Carry On movies. I don't know why.
Well, you know, I've just been
reading through the story, and you know what else I found?
What?
It's not just that it's a sexy robot. It's a sexy robot who is not just Rosie the robot. She's Rosie the robot inhabited by the consciousness of Rosemary Jetson, George Jetson's dying mother.
What?
She's a haunted robot. Also, I feel the need to point out, I was wrong. Turns out there's two haunted tanks. One of them was possessed by General Sherman, but the original haunted tank was a M3 Stuart possessed by the ghost of General Stuart. You had some kind of first name.
So there we go. Actually, there we go. We've got the DC crossover. Tom King's Sergeant Rock.
Yeah.
The haunted tanks. He gets to fight. And then the reason that the haunted tanks are there is because they're fighting for the affections of Rosemary Jetson, who is the haunted robot in the Jetsons.
So are you saying Sherman versus Stuart? And
yes.
And the war is actually between them two, and the Nazis, yes, have nothing to do with it, and Sergeant Rock is like the referee.
Yes.
See, this works
for
me.
This stuff writes itself.
Yeah, I'm fine with this.
You know, there's absolutely going to be the line, it's not the size of the barrel, it's what you do with it.
Yes.
Absolutely. And it'll still sell more issues than the Flintstones versus Booster Gold.
We don't acknowledge the existence of the Flintstones versus Booster Gold.
But you have to, because it's mentioned in that story that you've just done about the Jetsons.
Yeah, but Batman Elmer Fudd is a thing, and we don't want that to exist either.
That's true. Maybe we ought to stop not wanting things to exist, because it seems that as fast as we don't want things to exist, they become a thing.
Hmm.
I mean, I'd happily read a Secret Squirrel Agent of Checkmate series.
Yes. I would happily not win the lottery or higher powers of the universe that do the opposite of what I say. Never make me win the lottery.
I would happily never spend a moment in the company of Gal Gadot. Right, we'll see how that works out.
Sorry. No, it's not that. I've just watched, yesterday I watched that Simpsons episode where they go to Israel, there's that scene with Bart and the little girl, and Bart's going, karate! And the little girl goes, Krav Maga! He goes, what's that? She goes, it's like karate, but there's more punching of the groin. And for some reason, that's transitioned to Dinner with Gal Gadot involves a lot of punching to the groin.
I'll take it.
On that note, shall we take a break?
I think that's wise.
Hello, do you like films? Well, wow, that's good. We're over the first hurdle. If you like films and you also like podcasts, you should probably check out the Geek Show's only dedicated movie podcast, Cinema Eclectica. Well staffed with a trained array of helper monkeys, we review all of the latest films every week and do it reasonably well.
Hello, I'm J. Michael Tatum and you are listening to The Geek Show.
The Geek Show is the largest independent podcast network out there. And to be independent, we need a little bit of help every now and again. So if you want something to show your love of The Geek Show, head over to thegeekshow.co.uk, click on the shop and buy some of our lovely wares. Buy them all.
Welcome back. And now we're going to be talking about comics and manga. And we're starting off with Mick.
Hello. Right. So this week's kind of a blast from the past, because it's another one of the mop-ups from Free Comic Book Day back in May. And this is Bad Machinery from Oni Press. It's a bit of an oddity. It's the start of a story called The Case of the Forked Road. And basically this is a series The Case of the Forked Road is volume 7. It's a series by John Allison, and it's described in the blurb as a hilarious series of paranormal mysteries. Now, I have no doubt that if you're about 13, it probably is hilarious. The artwork is quite primitive. I would say it's like one step up from Teen Titans Go. And basically it's about a group of school friends who have a sort of Scooby-Doo type extracurricular setup. They investigate mysteries and go through the general pain of school life. And that's about as exciting as I can make it sound. Like I said, I think it's really sort of aimed at an early teen audience. Within the group, you've got your typical science nerd, goth nerd, math nerd. Basically, the group are made up of nerds. And it's all right, but I think I'd have appreciated it a bit more sort of 30 years ago when I was two of the age where I would find drawing pictures of teachers that I didn't like amusing. So if you're in that age group and you're listening to us, I'm sorry for any content that may have offended you in the past. You might want to give it a try, but I think if you're sort of any older than that, maybe look for something a little bit more meaty to sink your teeth into.
So I think we've probably passed the point quite a while where we can be apologising for show content.
I know. I had so little to say about Bad Machinery that I felt I had to pad it out with something else.
Yeah, I don't think you need to apologise for stuff like Bad Machinery. And at the end of the day, it's aimed at a specific market. It's aimed at a specific audience, and the audience just doesn't happen to include you.
I didn't apologise for Bad Machinery. I apologised for any content of the show that may have offended listeners of the audience that would like Bad Machinery.
okay, it's a fine line.
Between love and hate.
I mean, let's just say that, but I had Glister last week, which seems like it was aimed at a similar audience.
Yeah.
And I still greatly enjoyed that.
Well, I think sometimes, I think if something's really good and it's aimed at a particular audience, it can still draw other people in.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't think when Buffy launched, I was its target audience, but I really enjoyed the show.
We're talking about the TV series and not the actual original movie.
Yeah. Right. And I'm sure, you know, let's face it, some would argue that some of the comics I read are probably not aimed at middle-aged men, but I read them because I enjoy them. So, that's Bad Machinery. I think if you're in the right age group and the right audience for it, you'll probably enjoy it. For me, it's just a bit flimsy.
Okay, Andrew, then.
Okay, so I am propping up the manga side of things this week because I've got Volume 2 of Queen Emeraldus by Leiji Matsumoto. So, boom, nailed that saying of the name. Pronunciation. Forgot the word pronunciation. That's completely undercut it.
Yes, it has.
So, yeah, Emeraldus, she's a space pirate. She flies around in a ship, the Queen Emeraldus, which is basically a pirate ship attached to a blimp in space. And it's weird, because the stories themselves are fairly simplistic.
Yeah.
It's basically, you know, Queen Emeraldus, she goes to a planet, she meets some people, one of them's probably a bad guy who wants to take her and do nefarious things with her, so she'll slice him in half with her gravity saber. And the art, it's quite rough, because, I mean, this dates back to, like, what, the 1970s?
Yeah, something like that.
And it definitely shows its age a bit. But it manages to, like, kind of almost transcend that to be something quite beautiful. Like, there's this great sense of just space exploration being, like, this really beautiful but desolate thing. Because it's basically combining the ideas of, like, old-time pirates and also the Wild West frontier.
See, I like that.
Yes, we've got, like, loads of people who will set off from a planet, like, deciding, I'm going to find my fortune and glory on some far-flung planet. But the way will be full of peril and danger, and most of them will die horribly.
Just like the real-world pioneers did when they went west.
Exactly. Like, there's one bit that's really great, because Emerald, she's kind of more of a bystander in some of the stories. And there's one where she goes to a planet and she meets a guy whose name is Zella, I believe, like Z-E-L-A. So that's a thing. Leiji Matsumoto likes his names to be like Z-E, random consonant A.
Yeah.
I think it was like Zella, Zeta, Zera, all manner of things. And it can get quite confusing.
Is there a Xena in there? I have to ask, is there a Xena?
No, I was just saying there's no Xena. Terrible minds think alike. But anyway, she meets this guy, and he's completely obsessed with getting off planet and passing through. Basically, there's like two suns that orbit the planet, or the planet orbits, because that's how physics works, Andrew. And because they're quite close to each other, there's like a field of flame between the two. And this guy's completely obsessed with like building a ship that can pass through the flames. Okay. And, you know, Emeraldus is trying to figure out why. And she asks around, and, like, all the looks like, well, we've got a bet to see if anyone can do it. It's like 1,000 yen, which I believe is, like, pocket change. Then she meets this woman who says, oh, yeah, I told this guy I'd marry him if he can get through the flames. Because, you know, I knew it was a completely impossible task. But then she actually talks to the guy, and it turns out, like, he's not doing it for any of that. He's just doing it because he spent his entire life kind of staring up at this field of fire, and it's his one life dream to actually pass through there. And you know what? He does. By which I mean, the heat shielding on his ship fails and he burns to death inside his capsule. But then, like, you've got this bit where Emeraldus finds his corpse, basically says, you know what? His death isn't a tragedy because he died kind of in the pursuit of his one true dream.
That's a nice sentiment.
Yeah, it's kind of, the whole book's kind of sad and lovely, except for the bits where, like, Emeraldus meets a space pirate who blows up planets. So she goes to his planet and blows it up, because she's having none of his nonsense.
So she's still imponderable.
Oh, yeah. She is the imponderable sorceress of space. And she ain't got no time for fools.
Ain't nobody got time for that.
I love Emeraldus. She's so cool.
Yeah. thing is, Leiji Matsumoto, if you've read any of his other work, like Galaxy Express and Harlock, he's very much the old, you remember the old-style sci-fi writers like E.E. Doc Smith and Asimov, old Asimov stuff.
He's
very much in that mold.
Yes, and I like that, because one of the things about a lot of modern science fiction is that a lot of the mystery has been taken out of space.
Yeah.
Like, it's just a thing that people travel through. And I like that Queen Emeraldus really catches this idea of, like, just the wonder of saying, hey, what's over there? Also, it reminds me a lot of The Silver Surfer.
Yeah.
Instead of, like, this one lonely figure kind of morosely drifting through space, but also getting caught up in, like, how beautiful things are. And someone tries to mess with them and they kill them in, like, a panel.
Yeah, because no one messes with the surfer. Which sounds like...
Emeraldus could mess with the surfer.
Now, the thing is, saying no one messes with the surfer sounds like such a 90s thing to say.
It sounds like... That's like the tagline to Point Break.
Exactly.
I think I've accidentally ruined the Silver Surfer for myself.
You mean Fox didn't do that for you?
Even more than Fox, just the idea of, like, space Patrick Swayze. By ruined, I might have meant made infinitely better.
Oh my god, now I've just got the Silver Surfer in a Dirty Dancing montage.
Has anyone with professional certification ever tried to figure out how your mind works?
Yes. They failed.
Was their name Quinzel by any chance?
No. They said my mind was like a Rubik's Cube. They're sure there's a solution. But they
and
might
then
have...
they said something about how where we're going we won't need eyes, and then stitched them shut.
No. They said that my mind is like a Rubik's Cube, but in order to solve it, they might have to take all the stickers off and put them back on in the correct order. Because some people did that to pretend they solved the Rubik's Cube.
Not pretending to solve it, Rob. It's thinking outside the box. Do you know who'd solve a Rubik's Cube like that? Queen Emeraldus.
Exactly.
No, she wouldn't. She'd probably just shoot it.
No, she'd break it apart and then put it back together. She wouldn't bother with the stickers.
No, she wouldn't. She'd like break it apart and then leave it broken as a message that any who dare try and give her unsolvable puzzles will meet a similar horrible fate.
Oh, you gotta love Emeraldus.
God damn, she's so cool.
Oh, so moving from space to giants. I kill giants, in fact. Well, I don't personally kill giants.
Don't.
Sorry?
No, you don't.
No, I don't personally kill giants. I Kill Giants was a 7-issue series that came out from Image in a few years ago. I think it was almost 10 years ago now. 2008? Yeah, 2008 it came out. It was written by Joe Kelly with art by J.M. Ken Nimura. And it's a very, very odd, but very, very interesting and kind of beautiful story. I mean, there's a lot in there for 7 issues. The basic story is about a young girl called Barbara Thorson. She's a bit of an outsider, and she's a total geek. She's obsessed with Dungeons and Dragons, and she has literally no friends at the start of the story. She's got her family, she lives at home, and there's something strange going on, because she has an obsession with giants. And when people ask her, what does she do? She stands up and says, I kill giants. And she's very, very strange in that way. She's got a Norse Warhammer drawn on her little kind of purse bag type thing called Kovaleski. And she says that when Kovaleski speaks, the world cries. And it's got some brilliant lines like that, by the way. These are lines that if you heard them in like Brander's version of Thor, they'd fit in totally. She's convinced that giants are real, and she's also convinced, absolutely convinced, that giants are coming to destroy the world. And she sees signs in the clouds and, in the weather, in the flight of birds, and she also sees these little sprites and fairies. And there's this weird line between what's real and what's not real, and you're never quite sure, even at the end, whether she's actually telling the truth or whether it's all just her own hallucination that's actually going on. As you go through the story, she meets a friend, a person who's a new girl in school, who because of the way she is and because of how violent she is, because she kills giants. She's the target of bullying because she's a geek, but she also fights back, which makes the bullies fight back a bit more and also become vindictive. And this new friend of hers kind of gets caught in the middle. And all that comes to a head when they're destroying the traps that she's laid by the river, only for all of them to come face to face with something that is effectively unkillable. A titan. Not a giant, but an actual titan. And the titan says to Barbara, "I didn't come for her, I came for you." Because Barbara's got one big fear, and it's the thing that drives the entire thing. And it's the reason why she's scared of going upstairs in her home, because of the thing that lives there. And the thing that lives there, the thing that she doesn't want to see, is her mother who's dying. And this is the thing, this is what's... There is this idea that this trauma is what's caused her to have these hallucinations, but because her friend and the bullies also see this titan in the river and see Barbara fighting the titan and see the hammer emerge from her purse, you know, the hammer Kowalewski emerge from her purse, that it throws the idea of it being just a straight up hallucination. And then you start thinking, well, hang on, is it actually real? Is what she's doing, you know, is what she said actually real? Does she actually kill giants? Is she just this little girl protecting the world from giants? And, you know, there's a lot of catharsis come the end. The artwork takes a little bit of getting used to, but, you know, it is kind of that scratchy, underground-ish style. But I think it really works. And the characters have very, very expressive faces. And I love some of the dialogue in this is just brilliant, especially Barbara's conversations with the school principal and the school counselor and just the people around her, because she's very much into kind of the Norse Viking protector mentality. And so when she speaks, you know, she's got that kind of bravado about her, that kind of arrogant dialogue. Well, not arrogant, that kind of machismo dialogue. Does that make sense?
Kind
of. I'm just sat here thinking, ooh, that's a lot of feedback. That isn't what I was thinking, but that's what I just thought when I got all the feedback.
Oh, right.
Andrew just suddenly changed into the Jesus and Mary chain.
Yeah. So, does that make sense?
Kind of.
Yeah, that makes sense. Drum makes more sense.
What?
Queen Emeraldus can fight entire planets.
Yeah, she could, but I've got to say, I Kill Giants came as a surprise. And I'll be honest, I like this comic a lot. I think that it's a really interesting story. And I love finding these, you know, limited run series where they tell a complete story, but they do it in such a way that you actually feel for the characters. They don't keep the characters at arm's length like they do with a lot of the superhero stuff. You know, there's always that distance between you and the superhero-based characters. You know they're not real, whereas with I Kill Giants, Barbara could just be a real person with mental health issues.
But you know she isn't, Rob.
I know she's a comic book character. I'm just saying that I wouldn't put it beyond the bounds of possibility that maybe somewhere in the world there is a little girl who stands up in class and says, "I kill giants," and draws pictures of a Norse Warhammer called whatever. Who's next?
I believe that's me, and I'm going to take you out into space.
Again, we just got back from space.
Yeah, but this is going to be a fun romp in space because we're going on board the Firefly-class ship Serenity.
My second favourite space pirates.
Technically, they're not space pirates, Andrew. Technically, they are... What was the word for them? I've forgotten the name. Privateers, that's it. Technically, yeah. They are privateers.
Just some private citizens making their way in the verse.
Exactly.
And the nice...
It's in line. I think they're really a bunch of big damn heroes.
The nice thing about No Power in the Verse, which ran for 6 issues from October of last year to March of this year, is that if your last contact with the crew of the Serenity was the TV show or the 2005 movie, it's like putting on a pair of comfy slippers because the writing has got the characters right down. The artwork, in the most part, is really accurate, which I find tends not to be the case with TV movie tie-in comics. you tend to be looking at a character who you've seen on the big screen played by a particular actor, and you read the comic and they've got, like, you know, 3 foot shorter and a different coloured hair and a face that's almost unrecognisable. But with this one, they've really captured the likenesses for the most part. There's a few frames where it's not quite as perfect and there's a little bit of ambiguity, but generally speaking, you're picking up. I'd say after the movie, it is after the movie for me, but there is a comic series in between that I've missed out on, but I shall probably go back and dig out. But No Power in the Verse sees the crew of Serenity hitting hard times. The economy is taking a battering in the verse, so it's harder and harder to get the big jobs that pay good wages. So our heroes are found trading life's essentials on the outer planets, because nothing smacks of giant payday like bog roll. So tensions are high on the ship. People are struggling to come to terms with all the effort they're having to put in for relatively low paydays. The food situation's not great. They're struggling to find the money to pay for repairs to the ship. And particularly Jane, but generally the rest of the crew as well, are all getting a little bit fractious. So luckily, a distraction comes in the form of an old friend who's disappeared. And their friend has contacted the Serenity and said, "Help me find them." And it looks like at the end of issue one, we're going to end up having some more run-ins with the Alliance, and there's going to be some heroics to be done, and Mal and the crew are going to have to do them, and it all looks like it's going to turn out shiny. So I'm really looking forward to the rest of the series, and as I say, I will probably be going back and picking up the one that I missed in between movie and this series. But yeah, it's always nice when you're reading a tie-in comic and everything feels familiar, that the characters have been just as you remember them. The chemistry that you get from the TV show and the film between the main crew is there on the page, and it lifts it up, and it's just so, it feels so much more than just a, you know, let's try and keep this cash cow getting milked. It feels like there's some genuine love for the source material amongst the creators.
Okay, so.
Well, I mean, I guess with things like this, it's probably more because the people writing it, probably actual fans of the show, rather than just some random desperate for work writer that, like, the networks had to smash out a tie-in for the Hockney movie.
Yeah, but I mean, we've mentioned in the past times when the fact that the writer is a fan has sometimes worked to the detriment of comic series. I mean, I think we mentioned that when we were talking about recent runs of Harley Quinn.
Actually, yeah, that is also a good point.
And I think maybe the fact that sometimes I think if fans write ongoing series, that's when it tends to become problematic, because it's difficult for them to pull back from doing all out fan fiction. But I think if you turn around to them and say, right, you've got 6 issues, tell a story.
Yeah, and I guess maybe not fan, but at least someone like understands why it is that people like these characters.
Yeah, but no, I think it's the kind of show where, if you're a fan, you do love these characters, and I think that comes across. There's a genuine love for the source material coming through. But I think, you know, limiting it to 6 issues is probably a good thing. It's a Dark Horse publication, and given when it came out as a miniseries, I would imagine it'll be out as a trade paperback in the not too distant future.
Good stuff. Also, God damn you for bringing up TV series that I love and that aren't around anymore.
I'm sorry.
Because Orphan Black just finished, Mick, and I'm not okay.
I'm not okay either. I feel your pain.
Every morning we have to wake up now and know that there'll never be a new episode.
Ah, but just think that in the future, everything that Tatiana Maslany appears in will just be a spin-off from Orphan Black.
What if she never appears in anything ever again?
She will.
She will. She will.
I hope so.
Not only that, there is an Orphan Black comic.
Oh, they should do. Orphan Black audiobook. Tatiana Maslany reading every single character.
Oh, the further adventures of Tatiana Maslany. You don't need to call it Orphan Black. Just call it that and make it like a weekly series.
Oh, no. That should have been how it ended. the Clone Club, they should have got the list of all the other remaining clones and should have ended with them going to visit one of them, who is a Hollywood actress called Tatiana Maslany.
Yes.
And then the universe implodes on itself.
See, that would have worked as the ending as well, though.
Yeah. I think we should step back, though, from mentioning too much about the ending of Orphan Black, just in case
some
of our listeners haven't got round to particular denouement.
Which I can sympathise with, because my initial plan was to never watch it. And that way there'll always be an episode left.
That way it'll never
be over.
Yeah, it's never over. Anyway, I believe it's your turn, Andrew.
Yep. So, I have been reading something what I got for my birthday the other week, and it is Lock and Key. From IDW Publishing, written by Joe Hill and illustrated by Gabriel Rodriguez.
You didn't just get this for your birthday.
No, Rob recommended it.
No, that wasn't what I was talking about.
Oh, yeah, no. No, to clarify, I got the Master Edition for my birthday, which is, like, every single issue. All, like, I mean, 6, 12, 18, 23. Must be, like, 30-something issues.
Yeah.
In glorious hardback.
Nice.
Yeah.
So, yeah, Lock and Key, it follows the Lock family, who are Nina and her children, Tyler, Kinsey, and is it Bode?
Yeah,
because his name is spelled B-O-D-E.
Yeah.
And it's like, it's almost Bode, but it's not Bode.
I think it's
got to be Bode.
I think it's Bodlock, yeah.
But that's not a name.
Who are we to judge what a name is?
Exactly. Well, we'll move on from that confusion. So, their father is killed, and so they have to go live on the island of Lovecraft, Massachusetts.
Yep.
To stay in the ancestral home of Key House.
What could possibly go wrong with that plan?
Lots of things. Because it turns out Key House isn't just a house. It's also kind of basically the last bastion guarding some kind of horrible secret that lies beneath the island. And scattered throughout the house are a series of keys, each one having strange and magical effects. So the first one we're introduced to is the death key, which open door, walk through, and he promptly dies and becomes a ghost.
Okay.
He can, like, fly around, spy on people, and just go back into his own body at any time.
So it's like an out-of-body experience?
Yeah, basically. Only one in which you can kind of control where you go, and also one that eventually these two characters having a ghost fight.
Yes.
Like using spectral powers to make swords and chainsaws.
But no tanks, unfortunately.
No tanks. Not even Squadron Strange has tanks. Because there's another character called Rufus who has some kind of ambiguous disorder. And he views everything through his army toys, who we call Squadron Strange. That's great because you get one issue from his perspective. And it's kind of done in the style of old war comics.
Yes.
So just to tie it back into what we're talking about earlier, it's a pitch-perfect parody. Well, back to the actual story. So they find these keys, but also what Bode finds is the key to the well house, where he discovers a woman trapped at the bottom of the well, who he kind of inadvertently frees, and she then reveals herself to actually be a he, because another one of the keys allows you to change your gender. And this is Lucas Caravaggio, who is kind of an old family friend of the Locks, who years ago used the keys as some kind of crazy ancient ritual, maybe become immortal, and also maybe open a door to some kind of hell dimension filled with black-eyed monster things that he now wants to bring in to destroy the Earth.
I'm beginning to see where this island got its name.
Yeah, it's a not-too-subtle reference to one of the writers who inspired the series. Almost as subtle as because Tyler joins the school's hockey team and one of their opponents is Voorhees Academy.
Okay.
It's like Jason Voorhees because he wears the hockey mask.
Yeah, there's a lot of references like that.
A lot of references to stuff like that. It's a great Lock and Key. It's kind of this weird kind of horror series. Some of the keys are really, really crazy. I think some of the highlights are the Mind Key, which is basically Bode finds it. And he spends ages looking for a lock that it'll fit in. And then suddenly it just cuts and you see the back of his head and there's just kind of a key-shaped hole there. And, like, he eventually uses it on himself and just, like, it makes the top of a person's head disappear. Like, you can see their thoughts.
Okay.
Wow.
Is it all their thoughts, like, anthropomorphized people? And you can just, like, pick them up and take them out and just make people forget things. Okay. Like, one of the other kids, Kinsey, uses it to basically make herself completely incapable of feeling fear or crying, which turns out isn't a super great idea.
Yeah. Fear is the defense mechanism, after all.
And it stops you making terrible, terrible decisions.
Yep.
Like maybe asking the guy who's secretly trying to bring about the apocalypse if he wants to be your boyfriend.
That's not a good idea.
No,
no, it isn't.
That's the kind of idea that should carry a health warning.
Yeah, I love it. It's weird, it's creepy, it's got lots of Lovecraft elements. I've got to admit, the one thing I didn't like at first was the art. So I feel like in the first few issues it's quite cartoony.
Yeah.
But that definitely gets toned down in the later issues. That gets a nicer finish as well. And they end up doing some really creative stuff. Like I already said about the war comic one.
Yeah.
Then there's another one where Bode finds another key that can turn you into an animal. And just the whole thing is done in the style of Calvin and Hobbes.
See, that's one of the great things about Lock and Key is that they play around with these things.
Yeah. And like buying the style cover, I mean, like literally every page is a four panel strip. That's just, it's such a creative idea. I love it.
Yeah. I mean, it's weird because Lock and Key was such an unusual title when it came out. And a lot of people really jumped on board with it. And I think it's one of the reasons why I kind of like Gravity Falls is because I read Lock and Key before I watched Gravity Falls.
Yeah, from what I know of Gravity Falls, that they are quite similar. Only Lock and Key is a lot more violent.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. You know, Gravity Falls is nowhere near as violent as Lock and Key, but they've got similarities in kind of the style and the delivery of some of the things as well.
Yeah, and that one episode of Gravity Falls where a guy gets his face caved in by an ice skate.
Yep.
I might be getting those the wrong way around.
You did get those the wrong way around.
Also, it has shadow golems. Yeah, which shadow is just a thing that every comic book should have.
Yeah, shadow golems are cool.
They are cool.
I love Lock and Key.
Sometimes I feel I'm the only person who hasn't read Lock and Key.
Because you are. It's actually a big conspiracy against you.
Right.
But we all meet up and laugh about it behind your back.
That's all right. I won't overreact. I shall simply kill you all.
Okay, so shall we end with me then?
Yes.
Yep.
Yes, let
me. There we go. That's the end of the show.
Well, let's end with Batman, The Dark Knight, Master Race. Now, we got sent from Penguin Random House and DC, we got sent an uncorrected proof advanced reader's copy of Batman The Dark Knight Master Race.
Oh, no.
By Frank Miller.
Oh, no, Rob, no, we can't do this.
No, why?
We can't start the show talking about Nazis and end with a book called The Master Race.
Why not?
That's called bookending.
Yes.
That takes us full circle. It's a perfect ending.
Exactly. You know, it's a story by Frank Miller and Brian Azzarello. It's got art by Andy Kubert and additional art by Frank Miller himself, Eduardo Risso, John Romita Jr. And yeah, you can tell. So
why would you get all these good artists and then also let Frank Miller do some of the art?
See, this is the thing. This was originally released in kind of issue form. So you had issue 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, whatever. And the story is very, very simple. It follows on from the second in the Dark Knight series. And
which, as everyone knows, is the best part of the Dark Knight series.
It starts off with, obviously, Batman is being chased. Clark Kent is trapped in ice. Lara, who is his daughter, or the daughter of him and Diana, Wonder Woman, she's unhappy with the situation of the world. Atom is Atom and still Atom. You know, the rest of the superheroes are old and blah, blah, blah. And people have started taking over the mantle of the Bat just because they can. Nobody knows what's going on anymore. The world is in this state of flux. Everything is going to pot. Oh no, we need a hero to save us all. And who is this? Who is this hero who's going to save us all? Is it Samson? No. Is it Hercules? No, it's Frank Miller. No, it isn't.
You can't make jokes about Frank Miller appearing in his own comic book as the superhero who saves the day, because that's something Frank Miller might do, Rob.
I know I'm preempting him, because I know...
I worship giving him the idea.
He's probably had the idea already. Somebody's probably suggested it to him, and that somebody is probably Jim Lee.
Dark Knight 4. What if Batman just started wearing a fedora all the time and hated women?
Yes, this is a possibility. Anyway, Master Race, believe it or not, is not about Nazis, but it is about Nazis, but it isn't, because they can't be Nazis, because they're Kryptonians. But where have these mysterious Kryptonians come from, you might ask? The planet Krypton was destroyed ages ago. Well
apart from Kaldor City.
Is it Kaldor?
I think you mean Kandor, yeah. Mick.
Well, excuse me if I got one letter of a city name wrong. He forgot about an entire city.
I was leading up to it.
Yeah, I think in a comic-based thing, everybody knows that there is a city in a bottle that is the last remaining part of Krypton.
Yep.
So I think you were building up to a conclusion that was not in any way, shape or form gripping. I do apologise.
No, it wasn't gripping.
This is why you don't get invited to surprise parties anymore.
Anyway, you have a guy in Kandor, and this man is called Qua for some reason. And Qua has an issue. He's got a problem. He's got a chip on his shoulder. He doesn't understand.
His name is the most ridiculous thing I've ever heard.
Yeah, I know. He has an issue, though. He's got a chip on his shoulder. He doesn't understand why Kal-El, with all his power, why isn't Kal-El ruling the humans? Why is Kal-El such a sissy pants? Why is he happy to let the humans rule the world? Why isn't he ruling them with an iron fist? I know I'm going to escape from Kandor somehow, using some weird means. I'm going to escape from Kandor with a bunch of like-minded individuals who also follow my ideals and my ideology, and we're going to leave Kandor, we're going to destroy the city in a bottle and become normal size, and then we're going to run rampant all over the world, along with Kal-El's daughter, who I'm going to say, love me, love me, love me, and, you know, give me your unconditional love, and, you know, also become the mother of my children, just like all these other Kryptonian women.
Okay, so, with the exception of the breakout from Kandor City,
yep.
This is all sounding so far so Zod.
Yes, so far so Zod. And it literally is so far so Zod, because Qua gets away from Kandor and Batman gets beaten up by Kryptonians. Everything is going to pot. The Kryptonians decide in their infinite wisdom, because we know Superman, ergo all Kryptonians on planet Earth, have only a few weaknesses. Red and green and even gold kryptonite, wherever the hell that is, and magic, yeah?
Mm-hmm.
So, if you're a Kryptonian, there are a couple of places on planet Earth that you probably don't want to go and invade. One of them possibly being the island of Themyscira, where Diana and the Amazons live, and where they can wield magic as part of their weaponry, and also where the women are just as strong as Kryptonians.
Yeah.
And also, every single one of them is a warrior. Unlike the Kryptonians, who, if you follow the Superman mythos, a lot of Kryptonians were scientists, not warriors. That's one of the reasons why Zod was able to cause so much trouble.
Yeah.
Please say this comic ends with just the Amazons getting all the Kryptonians in headlocks and giving them nuggies.
Well, basically what happens is...
a bunch of nerds.
Basically, Superman and Diana's daughter, Lara... she gets pulled in by Qua's... basically, she turns into Melania Trump. She becomes Qua's right-handed woman, but hasn't given herself over to him fully, hasn't become the mother of his children yet. Diana's not happy about the fact that her daughter, who she raised as an Amazon and trained as an Amazon, is willingly following crazy words of a crazy guy.
But does Qua at one point out that it's not just the Kryptonians? The Kryptonians and the humans are equally at fault for this situation.
Weirdly enough, He kind of does. I know, I laughed at that as well. Yeah, okay, the president has changed. They do put President Trump in this comic. But so the Kryptonians decide to attack Themyscira. Lara basically says to Diana, you know, Mom, just surrender. You know, you're going to be ruled over by us anyway. And Diana goes, yeah. Lara wants her brother Jonathan. She wants to take her brother Jonathan away with her. And so Jonathan can be raised in the doctrine of Kwa and become basically a space Nazi.
Hope Diana gives Kwa a swirly.
Yeah. Well, Diana basically gets all the Amazons and they tear the Kryptonians several new ones, not just one. They tear them several new ones. And I mean tear. The Kryptonians effectively don't know what hit them. Not only that, Kwa is doing some weird genetic shenanigans and some of the male Kryptonians are starting to look a bit Quasimodo-ish. Not sure what's going on there. Meanwhile, Batman, in order to save the world, has defrosted Kal-El and said, okay, Clark, we need your help. We need to get the old team back together. So they get the old team back together. The Flash, Diana, Green Lantern, the Atom, everybody gets together in kind of, I don't know how to describe it. It's like when the Justice Society reappeared, but everyone was kind of, everyone was a granddad at that point. And they all appear, but it's Frank Miller doing it. So everybody looks really crotchety and really wrinkly. And you just imagine half of them saying, get off my lawn.
I believe what you're looking for is an example of the sad inevitability of time.
Yes. So anyway, they're all going to fight against the Kryptonians. And Kal-El, Clark Kent, Superman, because he's been on ice for a while, quite literally, you know, he's not as strong as he used to be. So what does Bruce Wayne do? He gives him a suit. Now, you remember the suit that he used at the end of The Dark Knight to fight against Clark Kent?
Yeah.
Right? And you remember the lines then, you know, I beat you. He used the city's power to make himself just as strong as Superman. Right? Just as strong as Superman. Well, that's the key thing here, because he gives Superman a suit like that as well. And so the two of them go off to fight the Kryptonians. And so things happen. But this is where I get confused. And it is very, 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 very confusing.
Sorry, how confusing?
Very. With a capital V.
Because I'm still confused by the bit where the Justice League are going to go stop the Kryptonians who the Amazons were already beating.
Yeah, the Justice League are going to stop the Kryptonians and don't really make a show of it because, hey, not all of them can appear.
Yeah, but why?
Possibly because somebody broke Flash's legs earlier on in the comic.
No, I mean, like, why are the Justice League even here?
Not sure. Also, Barbara Gordon gets into a fight with a Nazi who's got swastikas over her nipples. Not sure why.
Well, probably she keep out the cold.
She also has them on her butt cheeks.
Again, to keep out the cold.
Again, not sure why. It doesn't explain. It just has, like, this random thing that happens to Barbara Gordon in the middle of this. I'm like, why is this in there? And you say to keep out the cold.
Maybe the Nazi was trying to say, actually, I prefer the term alt-right.
Yeah. Thing is, it's in there. You just think, is she not cold in that? And they purposefully made the character look a bit like Bridget Nielsen in Beverly Hills Cop 2. You know, huge, muscular, wearing very little, that sort of thing. But that's not the bit that confuses me the most. It confuses me, but it's not the bit that confuses me the most. The bit that confuses me the most is the end to this, with Superman taking on Kwa and his cronies. Now,
Wonder Woman stands in the background saying, no, seriously, guys, we had this. Go home, you crotchety old men.
Well, Superman, for some reason, right, Bruce Wayne is dying, because Bruce Wayne is always dying in The Dark Knight. And Kal-El, Clark Kent, Superman, he goes to take on Kwa, and his daughter Lara is with Kwa and going, Father, you're not strong enough to take us on, blah, 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 we're going to win, in her arrogance. Only for Clark Kent to finally take the limiter off. And this is the thing that confuses me, because there was a scene in one of the, I can't remember whether it was one of the movies or the Justice League cartoon, where Darkseid has come to Earth and Superman is going on about how he always has to be so careful to control just how strong he actually is. how he could easily break people if he just loses control even a little bit, and how that scares him. And then he says to Darkseid, "But you can take it, big guy, can't you?" And then punches Darkseid in the face all the way across the city, or Kansas, or wherever it is. And this is kind of that moment. You know, he takes the limiter off, and he fights like Batman fights. So he's moving before they're actually moving. He's breaking bones before they've realized their bones have been broken, and he's doing this to Kryptonians. And Batman, you know, Bruce Wayne is sitting there going, "You bastard, you were going easy on me.
Why are you even there, Batman? You're like 90 years old."
Yeah, but this is the thing. It basically makes a mockery of the ending to the original Dark Knight graphic novel, because apparently Superman was holding back. It also makes a mockery of the whole death of Superman thing, because apparently Superman was holding back against Doomsday as well. But then again, death of Superman was a mockery in its own right.
I'll be honest, you're not selling this to me.
Could I give it to you?
No. Nope. You name your price for me to take this off your hands.
Oh, no. Do you know the strangest part to this, right? The strangest...
Again, why are you there, Justice League? You're saving the day from a threat. That's like the Flash showing up to the scene of a fire as it's being put up, out by the firefighters, and going, "No, don't worry, guys, I'll suck all the oxygen. But Flash, we've basically put the fire... No, that's cool, guys. I'll save the day."
Yeah, but the thing is...
"But Flash, there's like 7 fires over there that we can't get to." "No, guys, this fire that you've almost already stopped is the one I'm going to stop."
Yeah, the thing that bugs me about this... After that whole bit, then Bruce Wayne dies, and somehow they bring him back to life, and Kal-El is also... Somehow, when they bring Bruce Wayne back to life, he's somehow younger. So now he's about the same age as his former teenage sidekick, who's now a grown woman, Carrie Kelly. So obviously somebody's going to be knocking boots sometime soon, because she's now taken on the role of Batwoman.
I mean, it seems like, what, a Lazarus pit or something?
Something like that, I'm assuming. So, yeah, Bruce Wayne is now young again. Clark Kent and his daughter Lara, who caused all sorts of problems, she's now having to learn about humans from her dad, and she doesn't understand why he loves humans so much, and now she's going to learn why he loves humans so much. And I'm thinking, hang on, didn't she live on the farm with her grandparents for a while as well? Not just... And also, she was... raised by Diana, and Diana would have hammered in some manners into her as well. So how the hell did she end up like that? That's just bad parenting.
Sometimes people just suck, Rob.
Yeah.
And then they go out and they buy their stupid tiki torches, they stand in the middle of a field, they make their dumb racist hand gestures and act like they aren't just super racist.
See, I find it amazingly ironic that they go out and buy tiki torches.
That's cultural appropriation.
Exactly.
Filthy Nazis.
We want to get rid of anything foreign, but yeah, the torches you're using are foreign. No, they aren't. I bought these from Walmart.
They may be foreign, but they're really good.
That gun in your holster is German.
No, it isn't.
See, that's what they should do. Like, all these people who want to get rid of the foreigners should be made to buy American-made products.
Oh, God.
And not sit there in their broken-down cars trying to make just the lumps of processed cheese, sobbing at the future they've made for themselves.
Eating their full roast chicken from a can.
Yes. Oh, no, don't forget the pink slurry, the pink slime or whatever it was. That's now illegal.
Yeah.
Apparently it was a meat product. They're not sure what meat, though. So, yeah, that was Batman The Dark Knight Master Race by Frank Miller and...
And a bunch of people who should have known better.
All I can say to this is that... remember when you were talking about Martha Washington?
Yeah.
The Life and Times of Martha Washington? You said it was Frank Miller at his best?
Yes.
This is not Frank Miller at his best.
No, and I think Frank has developed issues over the years.
He has developed issues. I've read them.
And I think Martha Washington was probably when he was angry in the right direction.
Reading this, he seems like he's angry and confused and off his meds.
Yeah, he just seems, from interviews I've seen with him and from snippets I've looked at. I mean, I started reading DK2 and gave up halfway through.
Don't lie, Mick. Everyone knows that if you read the first few issues of DK2, your eyes literally melt out your skull.
Yeah. Yes, and it cost me a fortune to get these implants put in.
Also, that's the thing that I want to touch on, just to close. The artwork for much of this is fine, except for the stuff done by Frank. Sorry, Frank, but your artwork is scratchy as hell, and you have a tendency to put characters in very, very, very odd poses. I'm not sure why you keep doing the upside-down jumping thing. It confuses me. Or why one of the Batgirl costumes is purple and green. That, again, confuses me.
Or just why everyone looks like a giant slab of meat. Like a human-sized block of Spam.
Yes, they do. Especially the Quasimodo-type characters that Qua makes. I don't know why they look like that. It's confusing. Well, I do know why they look like that, because I read this, but, you know, I'm saying I don't know.
Are you sure they're supposed to look like Quasimodo? Cause isn't, like, basically everyone in Frank Miller's art slightly hunchbacked?
That's a fair point.
Yeah.
Sure, that's not just, like, what Frank Miller thinks normal people look like.
See, the thing is, there are issues in here that are done by other artists where the artwork is really, really good.
I mean, I object to you saying other artists, because that's calling Frank Miller an artist.
Technically, he is.
He's a man who draws for a living.
Yeah. Yes, I guess. Frank Miller is an artist in the same way that Morrissey is an award-winning writer.
Exactly.
Just because that award was for worst sex scene doesn't make it untrue.
It still counts.
Yeah. Even if all Halle Berry had done was that Catwoman film, she'd still be an award-winning actress.
Yeah. We should be marketing executives with our know-how about how awards work.
Yeah, absolutely.
Not just the people whose job it is, so that whenever Frank Miller says, I've got an idea for a comic, we just say, no. He'd walk over and take the pencil out of his hand.
Back to the special. Let's go back to your special self, Frank.
Take the wax crayons off him. Except even the ones he's eaten.
No, except for the dandelion yellow, because you won't find those in Crayola sets anymore. Anyway, that's us done for today.
Just one thing
that
I want to mention, if I may.
Yes?
No, change my mind. You're not allowed to say it.
I won't be on the next episode because I'll be preparing to hike across the south coast of England for charity. I'll be doing 100 kilometres or 62 English miles across the South Downs in aid of the British Heart Foundation.
That's us for today. We'll be back at some point with more comic-y goodness and manga-y goodness. But until then, if you like what you heard, then you can find us on Audioboom, iTunes, or the podcast provider of your choice. And if you're listening through one of those, then subscribe to the Geek Show Podcast Network. It'll keep you up to date with all of our shows, like Cinema Eclectica, Literary Loitering, Keyframe, various things like that. We are on Patreon now, so if you're a regular listener and you want to show your support, then you can join us on Patreon as well. It will help us get much-needed equipment and improve the quality of what we do, take us to the next level, that kind of thing. So please show your support. And that's a wrap from us. I've been Rob.
I've been Andrew.
And I've been Mick.
We'll see you all later.
Thanks for listening.